Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning. How's it going?
That's okay. Windy and rainy here.
Yeah, it's not super windy here. It's only rainy.
Oh, it was windy here yesterday. It was like 50 mile an hour winds.
Oh,
And I was supposed to fly yesterday morning anyway.
this just might not be your year to fly, Dad.
It seems to be. The gods are not smiling on me.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry to hear that. You were talking about how windy it is in Helena. That's like relatively new, isn't
It is.
it?
That's the change. When I first moved here in the mid-80s, it was not very windy, and it used to be our rainy season went all the way to mid-July.
Oh, yeah.
We haven't had that kind of fall weather in a long time.
That was a phone call between Lauren Korn, producer and host at MTPR, and her dad, Mike. Sometimes I feel nostalgic for growing up in Southeast Alaska, for the abundance of blueberries and wild salmon, and the whales that migrated north every summer. But I've also come to feel something else. I remember when I went back in 2019, there was a massive drought. The blueberry bushes were decimated, king salmon populations were struggling, and I even watched helicopters run wildfire bucket drills in a rainforest. It was clear to me then, Alaska was changing. I'm Sarah Aronson, a climate-aware psychotherapist, which means I'm trained to understand the complex psychological distress related to the climate crisis, as well as how to best support coping, adaptation, and transformation in the face of paralyzing anxiety, despair, and change. We've heard a lot throughout this season of grounding. I've talked with academics and experts in fields ranging from environmental philosophy to the pharmaceutical industry, and from Finland to Montana, trying to nail down what it means when our bodies seem to know that something is off with the seasons. And we've really focused on what role language plays in understanding our feelings, and what, if any, value it has when we're processing something like climate change. In this season, you've heard me talk a lot about the Menin-Halt Glacier in Southeast Alaska, where I grew up, and about the algae last summer that coated the Clark Fork River in Missoula, where I live now. You've heard guests talk about the disappearing glaciers in Glacier National Park, about their concern over endangered species, about more intense heat, drought, wildfires, and flooding across the globe. And you've heard young people grapple with the idea that they'll never know a normal climate. We didn't place a word to what our guests and ourselves might be feeling about those changes. But now, we think we have a word for that too. It's solastalgia, or a homesickness you feel for your home that's changed. In this episode, we'll feature a writer who compiled an anthology sourced from people coming to terms with the word and the feeling of solastalgia. And I talked to Lauren Korn, a Montana public radio host and producer, about her solastalgia for where she grew up. First, we'll hear Lauren's conversation with Paul Bogard, creator of that collection of writings called Solastalgia, an anthology of emotion in a disappearing world. Paul is a writer of many other books and a professor of English and environmental studies at Hamline University in Minnesota. Then we'll listen to Lauren and I try to tap into our own solastalgia and decide if and how that informs the way we feel about the places we love.
Hi, I'm Paul Bogard. I'm the author of The End of Night and The Ground Beneath Us, and also the editor of Solastalgia. I teach at Hamline University in St. Paul, Minnesota, live in Minneapolis, and that's me.
That's you. You, as you said, are the editor of Solastalgia, an anthology of emotion in a disappearing world. In your introduction to this anthology, you write that solastalgia is, quote, the homesickness you feel while still at home. Talk about what that means, Paul. What exactly is this word? Where did it come from? And I think maybe even more to the point, I'm wondering if you can describe the moment when you first experienced this feeling yourself.
Yeah, so the word comes from an Australian philosopher, a guy named Glenn Albrecht. Officially, he coined the word in about 2003. And since then, it's really expanded around the world and speaks for a lot of people to this feeling that we have of this homesickness you feel while you're still at home. And it's that, so I always, you know, distinguish it from nostalgia, which is a word that most people know, meaning, you know, missing a place or a time in the past. But solastalgia is really about missing the place where you still are because it has changed. I think In the End of Night, which was published in 2012, is I write about solastalgia and having discovered it kind of around that time. So maybe like 15 years ago when I found the word. I mean, I just like the sound of it for one thing. It was immediately sort of, you know, that drew me in. But then the meaning of it, I just thought immediately, I know exactly what he's talking about. For me, especially living in Minnesota, growing up in Minnesota, having a cabin in the northern part of the state and just, you know, seeing the, you know, just more and more people everywhere, more buildings, more warehouses, more highways, and the diminishment of some of the sense of wildness. I think it's important to have language that speaks to this feeling and that distinguishes it, I think, just, you know, from feeling sad or from nostalgia. Or so. It's like, it's actually a, you could argue that it's a new word for an old feeling. You know, people may have felt something similar in the past, but I think it is really useful to have language to talk about what we're experiencing now.
I'm really glad you mentioned language. You describe solastalgia as a way of like naming this feeling that people have been feeling for a long time. Does naming, both for you in practice, but also kind of theoretically, does giving language to the emotion give you relief? Does it give you a greater sense of responsibility moving through that emotion? Does it give you responsibility towards the landscape? I'm wondering how language prompts movement or action.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a writer and a English professor, so I, you know, language is definitely something that I think is really important, and to have specific language about this word does it for me. It gives voice to a feeling and allows us to speak to each other about something that we're experiencing. You know, feelings are hard to talk about because they're by nature kind of elusive, and you know, you can kind of be missing something, but you're not sure what, or feeling a certain grief, but you're not sure why. And this word just gives us kind of an immediate language to use. When I first discovered the word, I just thought this is a great word to describe the grief that I'm feeling. Kind of period, you know, that just, it's just, as we were saying, it's nice to have language for that feeling. But as, you know, the last 10 or 15 years have gone by, I've really discovered that the word is even richer than that. Like if it was just that, that's good, it's useful, it's fine. But it's actually, to me at least, even more powerful because it really points to the reason that we feel that grief is the love that we have for our places. And it's in that love that we'll find the power to respond and to act and to move forward and all those things. And so solastalgia, as useful as it, you know, is as a concept to describe the way that we feel, I think is also even more powerful when you think about it as a starting point.
Grief and love. Something I'm drawn to about the word solastalgia is it makes room for both. When Paul was young, he would record the sounds of the loons near his family cabin in northern Minnesota.
In the summer, I would record especially the loons, the sound of the loon. The loon is, you know, the common loon is the state bird of Minnesota, and their vocalizations are really magical. They have four primary vocalizations, but the one that they're most known for is called the wail. Just this like long drawn out call that oftentimes will happen on calm summer nights in the dark. And it's just, there's the story that the local indigenous people used to say that it was the sound of warriors calling back from the afterworld. Like, you know, it's that kind of just amazing sound. They go away in the winter. They fly down to the Gulf of Mexico or the Florida coast. I am trying really hard to speak to those things that I love and in some way do whatever I can to help them survive if that's possible. And certainly, you know, if it's not possible or ultimately, you know, they do leave, that I will, like we were saying before, I will have, you know, borne witness to their being there. And for what it's worth, I'll always remember. And I think my daughter will probably always remember them being present.
Paul, you mentioned earlier that solastalgia might be confused with nostalgia. And one thing that I myself personally struggle with is discerning the feelings of loss of like a home landscape from kind of like personal changes, whether that's just, you know, me growing up and having a different perspective on the world, or changes in, I don't know, losing my mom, for instance. Like, those personal changes have such a direct effect on the way that I see my home landscape. Do you maybe feel a difference? Like, really just like talking like physiologically in your body, the feeling of grief that you're feeling during solastalgia, is it different than the grief that you feel during nostalgia?
It feels to me like, you know, solastalgia is, I mean, it's about loss, but it's also about anticipated loss, you know? And so to feel solastalgia is to be mourning not only kind of what you're seeing happening, but also what you're, you know, thinking about will happen or what's been predicted to happen and that kind of thing. That seems different to me than, you know, sort of personal loss that we've suffered in a way. In some ways, solastalgia feels like a really subtle grief in a way, kind of an undercurrent of grief. It's all around us, and nobody wants to live that way. I don't think it's healthy to live that way. But so whereas at least, you know, the personal grief that I've suffered tends to be more sort of acute in a way, more, you know, a shorter time period. Solastalgia just feels like everything is changing. And some of the personal grief, which is very real and super powerful, feels a little more confined in some way.
Let's turn back to this anthology. You note in your introduction that solastalgia isn't just about loss. And I think you mentioned this earlier when we started our conversation. It's also so much about love, love of land, of home, of species. How do you see that love showing up most powerfully in this anthology, in this collection by so many different people?
Yeah, I mean, love is, I think, is the foundation, right? You know, we're not going to feel solastalgia for something that we don't love. And so it's the starting point for probably every essay in the book. What I wanted is, you know, for people to talk about their specific experience of solastalgia. Even the people who, and I had a couple, there are a couple in the book who wrote back and were like, I don't like the word, you know, you know, I reject the premise or whatever. It's like, awesome. Like, write that essay. Even those people are ultimately writing about what they love and the place that they love and how they, you know, maybe solastalgia doesn't work for them as a concept or a word, but it doesn't mean that they don't feel some of the emotions that we're talking about.
As Paul brings up people writing about the places they love, I'm reminded of the study episode 2 guest Renee Lertzman conducted in the Great Lakes region of Wisconsin. Her opening interview question that she took months to form was, "Tell me about the place you grew up." That simple phrase can unlock a lot of memories and feelings in people. It allows them to consider the changing climate maybe in a way they hadn't before.
You write in your introduction, you kind of outline the letter that you sent to authors. I found it powerful because the parameters were very broad. You might have wanted them to focus their writing on Solastalgia generally, but you write, I'm interested in how you're feeling. Were you surprised by any of the essays that you received back? And further, what did you learn from these essays? Like, what education did you receive in reading all of these essays together?
One thing I really love are the essays that speak to anger. I mean, there's kind of a joke in Minnesota that, you know, we're just kind of stoic Scandinavian people. I didn't really learn how to express anger, you know, which is, I wish I had. I think there's plenty of things to be angry about, but it's not something that comes naturally to me. And so it was really satisfying to read some of the essays and to include some of the essays where people are really, they have no such restraint, you know, they have no handicap in when it comes to anger, and they're able to, their soul nostalgia, I would say, comes through, at least in these essays, with in talking about how angry they are, which I loved, you know. So it's not a book full of just everybody. It's not just 35 essays of people being sad, you know. It's or maybe it is, but sadness comes out in lots of different ways.
Or even more pointedly, grief is not purely sadness, right? Grief comes out in anger, in sadness, and often, which is also kind of an overarching theme of this book, in great joy, in appreciation, and in loving these landscapes and these places. So, yeah, of course, we're not going to just be sad.
Yeah, no, that's well said. I think that's true.
I'm curious about the impetus for this collection. What made you want to kind of gather these voices for this book? And what do you hope readers of this collection, this anthology, what do you hope they feel or experience after spending some time with it?
I want people to realize or understand or be reminded that they're not alone. I think that was probably the main impetus for putting the book together. It reminds me of the dedication, which is to my daughter, which just says, for Amelie, that you know we loved this world.
My name is Lauren Korn. I am a producer on this podcast, Grounding. I'm also the host and producer of another Montana Public Radio podcast called The Right Question, where I get to interview authors about new books that they have out. I am from Montana.
Lauren, I remember when Grounding was conceived, and we even kicked around the idea of calling the show Solastalgia.
Yeah.
What is it about this word that speaks to you?
I think what I am taken by, or why I have so attached my own feelings to it, is because it so uproots, or since I've come to know it, it has uprooted my ideas of time and how I presence myself on landscape. Solastalgia for me, that feeling, is actually an anticipatory grief. Intellectually, and again, in my body, I am already grieving changes that have yet to happen.
I hear you talk about homesickness for home, but I want to add the condition of climate change, not just anticipatory grief, but homesick for a place that has already been degraded.
Mm-hmm.
Do you relate to that degradation of your home place east of the Continental Divide?
I think there are a couple of ways that I see that degradation. One being present climate changes, literally the difference between how I experience this landscape. I will say that growing up outside of Helena, I grew up in Montana City, which is about 10 miles south of Helena. It was such a sunny valley. There was no wind. There were mild summers. You know, like mid-80s was kind of the ceiling for a summer temperature, and really cold winters. Like, thinking about winters of my childhood, my hands get cold.
The one thing I've noticed too is snowpack melts earlier. The past 10 years, The snowpack has melted earlier than it has historically, although we still get late season snowstorms like in
July.
There were a couple. I remember sitting with your great-grandmother, Fisher, down at the Gulch watching the 4th of July parade in a snowstorm. We were all in the truck to watch the 4th of July parade, and it was snowing.
I mean, that would have been in the 90s or 80s. So that's 80s. There's always been late season snowstorms.
Yeah, weird.
There's always
weird. And I can remember Halloweens where you guys had to dress up like the Michelin Man to go trick-or-treating because it was so goddamn cold.
It is now, and I will say, it is so windy in Helena. I go home to Helena and the surrounding area, and I experience a wind, physically experiencing a wind on my body that it does not recognize. And that's a really strange feeling. I'm nearing 40, and to come home to a landscape where my body is so comfortable, I'm very comfortable east of the Continental Divide, but to experience something that is so uncomfortable and something that, I'm not used to, that's a shift. And that's something that I intellectually have to get used to and grieve, and physically as well.
And then Lauren turned the questioning on me.
Is there any sound that makes you feel like home? The noises that really ground you in your body?
Yeah. The humpback whale, like the spray, the breath that you hear. And that's how you'll know. You know, you might be standing on a beach and you might hear it, or on a boat, and it's like you can whip your head around and see the spray. And then you become locked into waiting for a breach or something. What's special about Southeast Alaska in the spring and summer is the varied thrush come back and they start wailing at 3:45 a.m. because that's dawn at that latitude. And the Arctic terns and the gulls that hover around the glacier, the glacier's receding. And so it's opening up all this land. So Arctic terns will fly 20,000 miles to nest. And they have these gorgeous, slightly irritating songs.
That reminds me of one of probably a noise that is irritating to a lot of people for very utilitarian or pragmatic reasons, but which I find very much a sound of home, which is a woodpecker. I grew up with the sound of woodpeckers pecking at the side of our house, which was cedar. And my dad, going to a hardware store to find a big plastic owl to scare the woodpeckers away, which didn't really work. Coyotes or coyotes howling at night. Summer's just they sounded like the desert. Like you can hear the dryness. You can hear the crickets. You can hear the sizzle. You can hear a temperature.
What are you grieving in anticipation when it comes to climate change?
I think what I grieve is the ability for the human and the non-human to be in conversation with each other. If we're using this idea of in connection with the non-human world, think of fire seasons here in Montana. When it's smoky outside, we don't really want to be outside, nor can some people even manage to be outside. And that is a separation. We have our bodies inside. We have, the natural outside.
Summers were very mild.
Yeah.
85 degrees was a hot day in Helena.
Uh-huh.
And rarely did it get into the 90s or the 100s. And now we regularly have 90s or 100 degree summers here. Because when I first got here, the thought of getting air conditioning was why?
Kind
it's
of
really
necessary.
Not that hot. And now, I have an air conditioner because the weather gets that hot. And it could be a byproduct of me just getting old, too, that my own personal metabolism is changed.
What's something that stayed with you from your conversation with Paul Bogard?
I'm actually glad you asked this. He reiterated his dedication. He dedicated this anthology to his daughter, and he wrote, "So that you know we loved this world." Yeah, I know I'm like getting all teary. Yeah, just thinking about it, right? I think why I'm getting so emotional, Sarah, is because that line, like, loved, like, presumes great loss. I think Paul's point in dedicating the anthology to his daughter with these lines is his focus on love. And I feel that too. Like, you can't feel climate anxiety or solastalgia or anything without deeply loving a place, a landscape. But I think in just like, in just reading that line, I think what I'm feeling is, again, like the anticipation of a different world. What made you so emotional about that line?
I mean, that's the word I use the most when I sit with my grief, is love. When every piece of writing and artwork I do in relation to the glacier is, I want to know that it was loved. It is already not the same body that I visited 6 years ago when I crawled inside of it, you know, and touched it. More than I want other people to know that I love the glacier, I want the glacier to know that it was loved by me because I felt so loved by it.
How do you love a landscape?
You sing to it. You write poetry to it. You make art with it. You dance with it. You know, I mean, that's what I was embodied with the glacier all along. I swam with it. I skied with it. I skated with it. I kissed people near it, you know. What's the language that you use to orient towards what I'm going to call a livable future?
You know, I don't think, Sarah, before this season of grounding, I would have taken so much issue or taken so many issues with the word hope. I think to be hopeful is pretty wonderful. It's a good feeling to feel. But maybe that's what it is. It's a feeling to feel. And, you know, in my conversation with Paul, and I think even in his introduction to his anthology, he writes that solastalgia not only invites its feelers to name and sit with that feeling, but it also incites action. And I think that is what I would want to name, although I don't know that I have a better word. You know, I know that you love the word resolve. I think there are others that have other words that incite action or evoke action.
Quoting myself, I've been known to say, hope is flimsy to me. It's not that actionable. It's an aspiration. And for me, I lean on care and love. Those are actionable. When I care about something, when I love something, when I love someone, I know exactly my marching orders. I know exactly what to do to move in the direction and to enact that care.
I appreciate that idea. I think you're right in that it's so, I hope it feels very abstract. It feels intangible, but care does not. You know how to care for another human. You know how to care for a landscape and vice versa. You know how to love them. We each have our own languages of love. Another word, respect, you know? That seems a little trite, but yeah, when you respect something, you care for it.
Well, like, we don't hope that our houseplant will get watered and stay alive. We water it. We fertilize it. We sing to it. We talk to it.
Yeah.
You know, we don't, we like, we know exactly what to do to take care of life.
Yeah, yeah. Why, Sarah, did you decide to ask your guests this season about their relationship to this word?
You know what? Let's hear it from the guests themselves.
It's a moral obligation. Hope is a moral obligation in the sense that this is what keeps us going.
Hope to me My like surface level definition of hope is like hope implies that we're going to succeed in a way that we can imagine right now. And I don't think we can honestly picture what it's actually going to be.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of the term hope. So I suppose I'm more kind of land on the framing around aspiration and around possibility. I also very much appreciate the language of repair and reparation.
So hope can sound passive, right? I'm just going to sit back and hope. Hope, though, is not, I don't think of hope as a verb. Hope is an emotion that pushes you towards the future.
This is a funny time. I'm having a little trouble mustering as much hope as I like to hold on to right now. But one of the terms that I hold on to is Joanna Macy's active hope. So it's not a noun, it's a verb.
As the years went by, I found myself more and more emphasizing the concept of meaning. And hope and meaning are very closely intertwined.
What is hope in Finnish?
It's toivo.
Toivo.
So I found that as hard as it is to get started, for me, action is what brings me hope.
I think of hope, you know, as this active and almost therapeutic practice for me of really trying to ground in not just what I don't want, but what I do want.
Probably stubbornness. Fear, if I stop moving, it's all going to stop in a way. And I guess curiosity.
I mean, I love that word, hope. It's a good word. We have to have it, or else we would just be crying all the time, right?
It really became alive in my consciousness in 2023 and 2024 when I was doing sort of public speaking engagements. And this word would get thrown around on panels and, you know, even in our conversation, Lauren, on the radio during Pledge Week 1 year. And I felt a strong reaction because I felt like it's sort of spiritual bypassing grief. Like We can talk about the aspiration of hope and as an orientation that feels optimistic. But really what like climate psychology literature points out is you cannot get there if you don't pass through grief first. Like that's the price of admission to get to an optimistic stance or a neutral stance. And so it just felt like we weren't really doing the work if we just skip forward to hope. But I was surprised from some of the guests this season, like hope as a moral obligation. You know, I can appreciate the ways that hope needs to occupy some space, but it cannot be the at the fore. It's not like the singular cardinal direction is like, let's move towards hope. That's flimsy again. It's like we have to go through the underground.
It also doesn't make a lot of sense to me for hope to be an orientation, right? It seems as though if we want to use hope, it is to get to another place. Hope can be a tool. And like you said, sometimes it can be a flimsy tool, it can be a lazy tool for some, but it feels like not the destination.
David Abrams, who wrote The Spell of the Sensuous, talks about calling this epoch the Humilocene, which like humility and humus or hummus is about soil, about grounding, about being earthbound. And I sometimes like thinking about that rather than the Anthropocene. It's like, how do we engage in the Humilocene? Let's get back to our roots. Let's get grounded. Let's get humble again. So what can we add to our personal dictionaries after this season of grounding? We unpacked what moral injury means as it relates to climate change and whether humans and nature are all that separate. And finally, we considered solastalgia. Did we answer any big questions or prove anything new? No, not really. But I think what this season of grounding taught me is that when we boil it down to talking about the places we grew up loving, we're not all that different. We're just looking to be reminded that we're not alone in what we're feeling.
Grounding is hosted by me, Sarah Aronson. Keely Larson is our executive producer. Editorial support from Lauren Korn and Claire Menahan. Engineering by Chris Moyles. Thanks to Michael Marsalek and Nick Mott. The theme song is by Brian Ramirez. Grounding is an independent production of Montana Public Radio's Arts and Culture team.